Welcome back to PS Editors Podcast, a bi-weekly conversation with PS contributors and other experts on some of the world's most pressing issues. I'm Greg Bruno, an associate editor at Project Syndicate. Today's topic, free speech in the digital age. On January 1, Germany became the global testbed for how to police hate speech online. The country's Network Enforcement Act imposes steep fines on technology providers that fail to swiftly remove obviously illegal content from their platforms. But almost immediately after enactment, the law was criticized. And today, some free speech advocates worry that it is doing more harm than good, not only failing in its efforts to prevent the dissemination of hateful content, but also disadvantaging other speech in the process. My guest today has thought hard about Germany's internet cleanup campaign and what it means for broader efforts to protect free speech online. Alexandra Borchardt is Director of Strategic Development at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, and she believes that despite the law's weaknesses, the German government is not wrong for attempting to impose a radical fix to a corrosive problem. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi.
Hi, it's thanks. Thanks so much for joining us on PS Editors Podcast today.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling me.
You're well versed on German media, having served as the managing editor for one of the country's largest daily newspapers, Süddeutsche Zeitung. Can you give us an overview of what the German government has just implemented with its Network Enforcement Act? How does it work and why is it necessary now?
Well, the Network Enforcement Act, I mean, it's a terrible name. It is necessary because the German government wanted to do something against hate speech because they felt they just wouldn't want to sit silently any longer and just like things happen, let platform companies determine, you know, what's on their platforms in terms of speech and what's not. It's a law. Basically, it forces platform companies like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube to remove illegal content, hate speech within 24 hours when it's when they're notified by someone who's affected. And if they don't comply, they could be fined with up to 50 million euros.
So this has been telegraphed for quite some time. But the definition strikes me as a bit curious. Obviously illegal, I think, is the term. How do we define that? Legal experts don't always agree on what that means. You know, and here at Project Syndicate, we've had our own hiccups with posting videos to YouTube, probably due to headline issues. How can we expect a private technology firm to define it better than lawyers can?
Well, they definitely can't. And I mean, that's one of the major criticisms about this law, that it's really impossible to define illegal. So we are actually looking at a period of trial and error here. This is not something clear cut, and it's also very hard for the people involved in monitoring the content. Nevertheless, I think it's justified to actually do something against hate speech because the victims of hate speech suffer very much, or they can suffer very much. And the legal processes are just much too slow to address hate speech because obviously every victim could go, you know, get themselves a lawyer or get to the police, whatever, because the content has been, what is illegal can be tried with the regular laws. But obviously that doesn't happen fast enough. Many people can't afford a lawyer. They're too shy to do something about it. So they just retreat from social media, or they suffer silently, or they suffer obviously. So there's really some issue that needs to be addressed here. If the law as it is now is the best way to do it, well, you know, that's another discussion. But this is, as I said, a trial and error experimentation phase.
So how are social media companies actually responding? What types of tools are they using? You know, I've read that YouTube uses something called machine learning and algorithms. What about Twitter and Facebook and the other platforms?
Well, obviously they have to use machine learning and algorithms because it's just so much content uploaded worldwide every second that they just can't monitor everything. But still, there's lots of manpower involved in actually looking at things that are pointed out. And obviously, there are mistakes being made, and some stuff is deleted that's not supposed to be deleted, or, you know, that shouldn't have been deleted. works of art, whatever kinds of things. I mean, you know, controversies around this. But obviously, yeah, there needs to be something to be done.
I mean, do you have any examples of obviously egregious or misidentified content that's been temporarily wiped from the face of the internet?
Well, the most famous was that girl, that iconic photograph of that girl from the Vietnam War that was running naked and fleeing from a chemical attack. And I mean, when that was removed, I mean, there was an outcry and there was, you know, lots of debate about, you know, that it's absolutely not possible to pick out content like that. But, you know, you could appeal to these things and then, you know, put these things back. So it's as I said, mistakes will be made.
So are the technology companies erring on the side of their economic caution because of the steep fines? I think that's the criticism of the German law, that in the context of giving companies the power to be the arbiters of what is illegal and not illegal, that the companies will always err on the side of fiscal responsibility from their perspective, which has the potential to damage legitimate and free speech.
Obviously, they'll be more cautious about what they're doing. But the real thing is that they got the message, they received the message, and they have to get active to do something about the design of their platforms to really shape them in a way that's conducive to, you know, better speech, whatever that is. They have to shape them in a way that prevents hate speech from happening in an extent that it does now.
I would imagine that censors in states like China and Russia are probably enjoying this debate very much. No one has ever really argued that the Great Firewall wasn't effective. Do you think that the German law represents a step in the direction of more aggressive control by liberal democracies? And might it be followed by further steps if the law fails to achieve its stated purpose?
Well, actually, I don't think so. I mean, someone said that, you know, oh, this German law is a blueprint for Putin. You know, I feel, well, Putin definitely doesn't need a German law to have a blueprint, or China doesn't need any advice from Germany how to restrict free speech. I mean, these are very different regimes. Germany, in contrast, is a free, liberal, democratic society and will stay that way. And so, you know, speech, as I said, will be free. And there are lots of ways to express oneself. And if you feel restricted in your free speech, you can also complain and, you know, things might change. I don't see this danger at all. That there is some need for regulation, that's pretty clear, because this regulation is about protecting citizens. And it's every democracy's right to protect their citizens, in particular vulnerable voices, so that they don't withdraw from the public sphere. Because, I mean, that's really what we are facing here, is if there's so much hate speech that minorities, women, other vulnerable groups don't really dare to be on social media any longer because they fear harassment or trolls or whatever, then they'll withdraw from this public sphere, and then we'll have free speech only for those who are the loudest, only those who get amplifiers anyway. So then the free speech will be gone for many groups of society, and that's really a right of a democracy to protect these citizens.
Right. That's one of the points that you've noted in your commentary, that often in situations where people are bullied, it's not the bullies that stop using the internet, it's those that are bullied. And turning off from social media is an increasingly common response in a hate-filled online environment.
Yeah, why should victims' rights count less than those of their bullies, I'm asking? And I mean, that's a legitimate question. And a government has the right to protect the citizens.
I think one of a German commentator commenting on the new law said, quote, "The only way evil can be rooted out is for perpetrators to realize that their actions on the web have consequences."
I know. I mean, sometimes they're really surprised when they find themselves in front of a court because they just never felt that, you know, this was sort of something wrong because it's so removed. If you're in your bedroom and you do something that's really hurtful to someone, you might not notice because you feel cozy and you don't have to face this person and you don't feel you facing any consequences. So these people are very often really surprised when, you know, they're really when someone really gets at them.
Right. So I want to turn, if we could, to solutions then. I wonder what the answer is. Improved algorithms, better machine learning. Apparently there's a new Facebook algorithm that emphasizes friends and family over news organizations. Will any of this have a limiting impact on hate speech, or are there other solutions that you can think of?
Oh, the friends and family thing, I'm absolutely not sure, because if you emphasize personal stuff and friends and family stuff, I mean, it can be even more hateful because obviously you're doing something against, you know, media brands, traditional reliable media brands being displayed. So that really doesn't help. I mean, we would have to start, or we will have to start at many ends. I mean, the first one is actually media literacy. What you said before, some people, or what we talked about before, some people just don't know how to behave on the internet. They just feel they have every right to bully everybody because it's their amplifier, it's their megaphone, and so they feel important. So you really have to teach children, even, you know, about consequences that their free speech might have, and, you know, to be respectful with each other, to you know what it means to forward things, certain images. So media literacy is one point. Obviously, the rule of law, it is in place, but it has to be modernized and adjusted to the new challenges, so that people who are really victims get their rights and they get it fast. The design of social media platforms is really important to encourage responsible use. Maybe something like, you know, do you really send this post kind of thing? If, you know, if there's hate speech in there, and then, you know, you can be alerted to that. I mean, it's like when you send an email and you get alerted to, oh, you know, you wrote something about an attachment, but there's really not an attachment included. So something like that, the design of these platforms is important, but also obviously the design of the algorithms that today just reward speech that gets the most economic impact, the most profits generates the most profits for the platform companies. I mean, there's something to be done about that, to, you know, have another incentive structure in these algorithms.
I like the idea of having an alert message that would pop up and ask if you really want to send that message. I could probably have benefited that from numerous emails in my life to friends, family, and coworkers.
Me too.
I want to end with a question that you kind of pose in the piece, and it's one about the future, I suppose, of the online experience. You wrote that no one has ever been guaranteed an audience, and that to have an impact, citizens have always needed to appeal to or bypass the gatekeepers. But the internet was supposed to liberate us from all of that, from the gatekeepers, so that we could all be publishers. Do you think that idealism underlying the vision was hopelessly naive?
I think the idealism is great, and I think the internet's done great things. I mean, it's really wonderful that people can get publishers. But obviously, since, you know, I think 2 billion people are on Facebook right now, the sheer mass of contributions of speech just needs some sorting out. And today algorithms are the ways to sort out speech. They are the filters, they are the modern gatekeepers. So it really depends on how you program these algorithms, because there's not a chance that every single human being on earth will be heard by everybody else. I mean, there's just absolutely no way this could happen. So you always need filter mechanisms. But I mean, it's still, there are great things about the internet, but lots of stuff has been just beta testing, and now you face the consequences, and, you know, things have to evolve. And obviously regulation has always been a part of the democratic process, because regulation is actually, it's a way in our democracies to just, you know, impose values and ethics on certain practices on people. And so regulation is just a natural part of democracy. And it doesn't mean that there's no free speech. It just doesn't mean, it just does mean that there's a sensible structure behind these things. And obviously speech needs to be structured, so, because otherwise everybody will just be drowned out in a lot of noise and nobody will hear anything any longer.
I always like to throw in a bit of my own personal observation, and I typically end up throwing my family under the bus. My wife has forsaken Facebook for probably 4 years now. Was she quite visionary in doing so, do you think?
Well, Facebook. What's Facebook? I mean, Facebook is just one platform, but they also own their own WhatsApp, their own Instagram. So there'll always be another platform. I mean, in our digital news report from the Reuters Institute that we do every year, last year's result was that 80% of all respondents, and I mean, this is a major thing, 70,000 people in 36 countries surveyed, 80% of all respondents use a Facebook product every week, at least one Facebook product. If it's Facebook or not, well, who cares? And I think Facebook as such might be, you know, might be on the downturn, but there'll always be another platform. So I think the platforms are here to stay.
Mm. Well, Alexandra, that was extremely fascinating. Thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thank you so much.
That was Alexandra Borchardt, Director of Strategic Development at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism. And that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate and review our podcast and subscribe on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and iTunes. Until next time, I'm Greg Bruno.